I want to say before I leave this subject of the SOS and General Donovan that the organization he built up was a very efficient one. It had very fine men in it, and they did a very fine job in the end, and they cooperated very completely with the Army, largely due to the missionary work of General Smith. And there was one time, I believe, when General Donovan and his headquarters were in differences with Elmer Davis and his work. And during that work, during that period, General Smith effected a great many adjustments which were very helpful in the long run of things. I do not wish to comment on the work of Elmer Davis and Lowell Mallett. Lowell Mallett was at the White House, and Davis was running a very large concern. I don't know enough about their work. A lot of these things would hit at me one way or help me in another, and I think it's better that I don't comment. And I might say again, and I want to emphasize this, that most of these problems that we've been talking about now developed during the mobilization period, that once the fighting started, once we got deeply into it, during most of that time, I didn't have these troubles at all. Everybody backed us and tried to help us. And it was only occasionally we got into difficulties, and that is only natural. As to press relations, I think we got a pretty well organized press relations section. I think in the main, the handling of the press section did not get too difficult, and I think General Searles did a very good job. I know he did for me, and I think he did for Mr. Stimson. 141. I was not briefed daily on editorial opinion. I got general statements at times, but I couldn't get into all this all the time. I was briefed daily on the complete layout of our operations when we had 9 theaters of operations, which was beautifully done, and I'll describe in detail later on. But I was only told about editorial things when they were very pointed. I myself scanned 9 papers every day, so I saw a good bit of this for myself. I found that if I got too deeply involved in this sort of thing, I lost my perspective about the war generally. However, that press relation, editorial opinion and all, was very important during the mobilization period. But after we got entrenched and at war, it was not so difficult to deal with. Every now and then some particular thing would come up, and some representative of the paper would encounter a discontented officer, particularly a senior officer who didn't think his way of doing the things was being followed, which he thought was far better than the way we were doing them. But if that officer was very articulate, sometimes that would be brought in heavy pressure on me. But that's only to be expected, and was treated in that way. 141. I've just answered
yes,
that.
You have.
142. I was in favor of the Stars and Stripes and the Yank. I thought, of course, that they got away with themselves sometimes. I think in a democratic army, a paper such as that is quite essential, as long as you don't find some individuals who are rather brilliant and take a particular joy in trying to take cracks at the officer corps or a particular commander. It's very difficult to control that, because if you begin to restrain it, the paper loses its cast as a voice of the enlisted man. Well, in an army of democracy, that's pretty near a necessity. And for that reason, I was in favor of the paper, though it was very provoking to commanders and all who had the responsibility for this thing. And here these privates or others with some writing ability were criticizing them or holding them almost to contempt to their troops. Not quite as bad as that, but almost that. And yet, I'd seen it in the First World War. I knew General Pershing's problems with it, so some very famous writers came out of the Stars and Stripes, and he had to uphold them against the strictures of troop commanders who were violent over the what the Stars and Stripes used to write. But if they were particularly violent, that was considered an achievement for the Stars and Stripes, and of course the men liked that. It's one of those things that requires very delicate handling, because it can easily go wild, and you can have one or two men in there, the more brilliant they are, the more dangerous they are, who stir up these things and are just trying to stir up a mess between the officers and the privates. The fellow's making a reputation for himself that he couldn't get in any other way, and he generally, you found him in prominent positions in writing after the war. All the incidents in 144 that you mentioned about public relations were difficult. The Patton slapping, the speech in London, the Darlan episode, the Yoho incident with General Lear, which was played up in a fantastic way by the press and made it extremely difficult for General Lear. Maybe he shouldn't have said it. Well, there are lots of things that you shouldn't have said yesterday that you're talking about today, but you don't have it handled by the press of the country to hold you up to everything that you said to your children. They could make quite fun of you if they could publish it all. And yet that was a very serious thing, because it was hitting at the prestige of a commander. But you have to tolerate that with some tactfulness in an army of democracy. But you certainly shouldn't encourage it. Now, in the Darlan episode, I brought down a group of members of Congress, and particularly of the Senate, very carefully selected men, and explained to them what the situation was, and read them a message, a long message I just got from General Eisenhower that day, which explained his point of view at that moment. That helped a great deal, because it gave us defenders on the floor of the Senate and the floor of the House, and they were very loyal in the fact that they didn't spread this all over the place. And there were some very strong men in it who were very settled in their own opinions. Matter of fact, we had about as much difficulty with English opinion as we did with American press opinion, and Eisenhower and General Clark had a very, very difficult time. It was hard enough fighting on about a 600-mile front with only 105,000 troops, but when you had to fight, really literally fight, all the editorial press and everything of your own country, that was really a difficult proposition, and I thought General Eisenhower carried it all very, very well and with great restraint. As to the papers, 145, that gave me the most intelligent support, I wouldn't care to go into that. Some of them did. Quite a few of them did, and were very loyal about it throughout the war. I'll only mention one, because it's in sort of a park by itself, and that was the Christian Science Monitor. And I felt a great admiration for the way they met the problems, not only then, but later when I was Secretary of State. Morale. 147. I had trained men, civilians, travel all over the Army and see the individual soldiers. And that had to be handled very carefully, because you don't want to begin encouraging the men to make criticisms, and yet we wanted to find what their reactions were. But they did it very well, and they graphed it for me so that I could see the thing graphically when they came back and rendered their reports. In that way, I kept fair contact. I did a tremendous amount of traveling myself, and I had all the officers who went made these surveys for me, in addition to whatever other duty they were performing. But having the airplane, we did a great deal of traveling and covered vast territory in order to keep in touch with what the morale factors were. The USO was invaluable. I started to organize that before they came out of the ordinary USO thing. I was doing it another, more primitive way, but one that would have gotten results much more fast. And then I discovered that Mr. Stimson had already started on the thing. And the funny thing was that I sent for this prominent civilian to come here, And he reported then, the message went to the Secretary of War, and he was coming. Mr. Simpson thought he was coming to him, but I had sent for him. And the officer didn't know what I'd gotten him for, so he worked out on the train how he thought this ought to be done, not the officer, but the civilian. He worked out on the train how he thought this ought to be done, and Mr. Simpson approved it, and he never even heard from me why I brought him back. So I had quite a difficult time over that, and it was concerned with the USO that I wanted him, but not the formal organization. I wanted to do something in the next 2 weeks, because the conditions in some of the southern towns were just terrible, and something had to be done in center. I remember I went to Milledgeville, I think it was, down in Georgia. I think it was Milledgeville. But wherever it was, I wouldn't allow anybody, I didn't have any aid with me, and the local commanders, there were two big training camps there. I had them just reserve a room at the hotel for me, and then I didn't have them stay around because I wanted to be perfectly footloose, and I was in civilian clothes. The net result was it was 6:30 when this started, and I never got anything to eat till 10:30 that night. Every place was crowded. I got it up at a lunch counter where I just had some warmed over biscuits and things of that sort. There wasn't a place to sit down. It is a town with very wide streets, and I think Milledgeville is the town, very wide streets, and a lovely central park down the center of the streets, and there were some benches there. But the town was so overstocked with soldiers that there wasn't anywhere that you could relax. And it was quite evident, unless we had something done immediately, that the situation could not continue without some outbreak of some sort or other. Well, that was so, even to a greater extent, in some very small towns, particularly, I think, one in Mississippi, where there was a division camp and almost no town. It took me quite a while to get the promotion policy settled. The trouble was, the board I had with General Craig at the head of it, who controlled the thing, would clear these blocks of promotion. And the trouble is, the officers in command would want to do it all at once. It was very nice to promote a whole lot of fellows. And over where the divisions were engaged in Africa, they held up a very high standard, very high standard, with the result that the man on the quiet front back home was getting promoted, and his teammates, so far as time of service went, was going through battles and getting wounded and not being promoted. And I had a very hard time getting this straightened out. I had to block the promotion very decidedly of some of the new service, like the anti-aircraft service and all, where they had tremendous increases, because they were promoting the men way ahead of, I thought, the time that it should be done, considering the man's efficiency. There was a place in the organization for him, but I thought the time had come when we could have too many second lieutenants and not untrained first lieutenants. And we finally got to the point where I wouldn't promote a division commander, a brigadier to a major general, until he'd served in command of that division in the field as a brigadier. But that was a long time before we could do that, because a great portion of the early army had to be organized without any fighting at all, and you had to have commanders. I remember when I had a delay in getting promotions done, and I was trying to press on the president the authority to do this, I found in some places, I had one place in particular, I found a major in command of 20,000 troops, and I was trying to get a brigadier general to command that lot of men. At first, with the tremendous increases in the army and the necessity of having some rank to control it, we had to promote a great many men far ahead of their, you might say, their training, their experience of that rank. I think I recall one case where we had 20,000 men under a major. And Mr. Roosevelt was very slow about this in brigadiers because it was so much faster than the Navy, but he never could take in the fact that I was taking in as many men a month as there were in the entire Navy. And once he proposed that I take the naval policy of doing it on a percentage basis, I accepted it instantly, and he got suspicious and questioned me and found out that I'd be making brigadiers twice as fast as I was already asking him to make them. In the matter of decorations for the purposes of morale, I insisted that they be given as near to the performance as possible, that is, on the battlefield, just as quickly as they could find the thing, promote the man, or decorate the man, if that were seemed advisable. I thought that was twice as effective as it is done there, and would have immediate effect on morale, and would put new fighting spirit into the men. That was opposed by the ordinary staff in Washington, because there'd be mistakes made. Well, of course there were mistakes made, but it was a greater better to have a man rewarded right then in the presence of the soldiers than to have to wait maybe 6 months when it was done without any immediate relation to what his performance had been of that day and hour. This was quite a battle. But I'd seen what happened in the First World War. I remember one case in particular where I went up and to see about a big raid that had been conducted, and there'd been very heavy casualties, and in the raid, very large captures by our men. It was a very successful raid, and I found in the group of 8 men selected for Distinguished Service Crosses, 4 who had been wounded in a previous raid and never been rewarded for that yet, and when raids in contact were very rare occasions, which ought to be treated immediately. And before I finished getting these fellows started, these 4 men, one in particular, the commander, had been in a raid that night, which had been very successful, and he was covered with blood from a hand-to-hand encounter with a German officer. And then word came that General Pershing was coming that day, that hour, and to that place. And I very foolishly allowed them to borrow somebody's clothes for this officer who was covered with blood, and I had them paraded particularly for General Pershing to see. And I had quite a hard time getting the staff to slow up. He had a long way to go, you see, to see these men and hear what they had done. And I regretted bitterly at the time that I hadn't left the fellow in his clothes covered with blood, except that I thought General Pershing might have thought that I was trying to force the issue. But the great trouble then was, in the First War, they had an officer for a time in charge of promotions and in charge of decorations, and he was about 6 months behind time. I remember I got a Croix de Guerre, and I was 5 months before it was delivered to me. I'd forgotten all about it by that time, anyone else who might have had any concern about it. And it was a very harmful to morale, because if you decorated the man then and there, he got it, and everybody else reacted to the spirit of the occasion. So I insisted on having battlefield promotions and battlefield decorations, and we'd put a limit on the number. I vaguely recall this, but I think I said that division commander could make one decoration for every 4 he recommended. Well, they said he'll make a whole lot of extra recommendations, and I said I'll relieve him if he does. And I let that be scattered around, so that put a little break on the thing. But it was very essential. If you're going to get your true reward for them, that was the purpose of the thing, to have it done at the time when everybody else could see what was happening and how the fellow was esteemed by the higher authorities. I had a great many measures of that kind, and I can't remember them all right now, but I tried two out to keep the reactions of the fighting man very alive and without the delays that come in red tape and approvals and everything. I remember I got the service medal out when there was sort of a stalemate there and no fighting particularly going on, and these fellows out on these islands in the Pacific. And it was a new decoration, and the president was rather critical of it. But I wanted, because I wanted these fellows on these islands to get some to show for what they were doing, and they all value a ribbon tremendously. So I insisted that the ribbon be given to them when they landed. Well, I found out that the terms of the issue of the ribbon was that they had to submit a request to the Quartermaster General in Washington. So I ordered the Quartermaster General to send a paper bag of ribbons to each port in that fellow was to get that the day he landed there. Well, they thought that was a wild performance. I thought it was a very wise performance. You can take this down after you eat your meal. Well, I've got to stop you.